Session number 27053.
Mr. Dre, Reel 2. We're talking about when you were in Lustley, and you'd already, while you were quite young, got this desire to join the army, and you were interested in the Armistice Day parades, the rest of it. I'm still coming back to this point as why had your father's experience, the fact you'd lost your father because of this, it doesn't seem to have put you off at all. Can you just perhaps talk
yeah,
about that?
Obviously, it didn't. Yeah, it didn't. I really didn't connect it. I used to think of my father. If I'd grown old with my father, perhaps I might not have liked him even. Perhaps I'd, different. But he's always been to me a soldier, like on the Western Front, and I'm always, I imagine my father always as a soldier because I can't remember him as a civilian or anything. But my mother told me, and we had photographs of him in his uniform and all this sort of thing. He was in uniform when he was married, and I always used to think that's my father, and they're so terrific. But I always liked this idea. And then I told you I had these books, the deeds that filled the empire, and of course they portrayed it as gallantry. You never saw a man being really blown to pieces. Only one or two that had won the VC by laying themselves on a live bomb when they dropped it, and to save their comrades. There was one or two like that. A little boy called Fitz McLadden done that, 18-year-old, when they were priming bombs ready for the attack on the Somme. Going back, I used to, all these pictures really portrayed them. You never saw what the horrible end of them. They were this winning the VC. Then what happened, in about 1934, I would have been then about 8 or 9, one of the teachers that I was under in Lustley School, she came from Newton Abbott. Her brother had been with the army in India, up on the northwest frontier, and she asked us if we'd like to listen to his stories of India. And he came fully dressed in his peak cap. I think he was in the Dorset Regiment, and he had the same uniform as my father had worn, puttees with the brass button tunics. And I thought, oh, that looks smart to me. And he told us all about in India, and he didn't describe any horrible fighting as such, although they used to, he glossed over it, sort of the fighting up on the frontier, but they were up there, and how they went around and everything was cheap and they lived and Indians were their servants, and even if they were only a private soldier, like these what they call Pungawallas and all the, the Indian, our lads that went to India brought back many of our words that are now incorporated in our language. When I mentioned to you just now about the bungalows that I've lived in, it was an Indian word that had been incorporated in our language because of our army bringing it back from India. Well, he told us this exciting story all about in India and how wonderful it was and the beautiful hills up in the northwest frontier where he'd been. That put me going. And then a little bit later, it got a bit more serious then. In 1937, they foresaw war was coming, and one evening, I'm only a little boy, and into the village comes two big lorries, all khaki painted, and had these soldiers in it. They were members of the 5th Devon's Territorial Unit, and they were coming in to recruit local lads from the village to join the Territorial 5th Devon's. They had these lorries, and they opened the back, and there were steps going up, and up then there was at the back of the lorry there would be a table, and there was an officer and a sergeant, and the sergeant was their typical soldiers. I knew them. They used to put wax on the end of their moustache and roll it, and so it had this point sticking out. It's called it a waxed moustache, and other lads gathered around, and some of these lads, they had this Vickers machine gun, and telling them all about the wonders of this machine, this beautiful thing that was that killed thousands of Germans on the Western Front. And I looked at this gun, and that, at all events, the moment come up, lads, if you want to join me. And so I got on the ladder with this lot, and it come to my turn. I was 13, I think I was 13 at this time, so it might have been a 38, I don't know. And I went up the ladder, and the sergeant said, "How old are you, boy?" Well, some wretched oaf behind me or something said, "He's only 13, sir." Well, I expect he'd have detected that before I opened my mouth, really. But I sort of wanted to give him a belt behind me. And he said to me, "Never mind, laddie, your turn will come, laddie. You'll be all right later on." And there were some wonderful posters on the side of this lorry as well. And it was soldiers marching through a town. It was it wasn't a photograph, it was a painting. And all these pretty girls clapping and waving as the soldiers were going through, and I thought, that's the life, really. Big machine gun, all these pretty girls cheering us on. And very disappointed, I had to come down. But the lads that did go into it, they all went, had to go, of course, in 39. There was quite a few from Lusty, joined the 5th Devon, Bobby Tracy here. But they broke it up. It never went in action as the 5th Devons. They broke it up. They become an anti-tank regiment and the artillery. So that leads me up to the war.
Before we get up to the war, what about any particular hobbies or I mean, were you interested in sport?
I used to play cricket for the boys' team. Not, I never played for the men's team in Lusley. That was they didn't need boys because I was too young. You see, I wasn't very old when the war broke out. But we had a school boys' team and cricket. I'm never terribly interested in football, though I used to play for wasn't a star player in the football. I didn't have much interest in that at all, really. I used to do a bit of running and jumping at school, like, and athletics and one thing and another, but I never shone in any of this sort of thing at all, really. No, I erred on the side of wildlife. I know considerable about nature and the wildlife, you know, that goes on all around Lusty. If someone said to me a certain bird where it nests, I'd tell them where to look. A flower in Lusty, still after all these years, if you're going to find one, you're going to find it so-and-so. And I could tell them all this thing. I used to spend a lot of time during the summer holidays. I used to organise parties of school children, and we'd hike from Lusley up on the moors or to Widdicombe and places like this, because we hadn't got the same facilities as children today, and we certainly didn't have videos and all this sort of thing. And so we used to make our own fun, and so we'd have a day out and go as a group. We were quite safe as a group, and walk to another village somewhere and buy a few sweets and look around and then walk all the way home again. It was quite good fun. I didn't really have any, never excelled in sport at all, really. No.
What about you mentioned the Boy Scouts.
Yes, I was.
What sort of activities? Because sometimes they're quite military, the Boy Scouts.
They are. But yes, they were. We had elementary drill and so forth as well, you know. And we used to go on camping. I must have gone 3 years running camping, not far away, down at Newton Abbott down here, a place called Denbury.
Tell us about the drill. What would you do on a night at the scout hut? I mean, what sort of drill? How sophisticated was the drill?
Oh, not really, mine. But, there was discipline with it. I mean, when they said, "Fall in," you fell in. And then they would tell us to it. And we used to carry like a broom handle, a pole each boy had in them days. We didn't have it all the time. But then when you fell in on parade, you had your pole. And you had to bring it up beside you, like, when he said attention. And then he would inspect you, and he would, just like an officer, if the woggle, that's the leather ring you had on your scarf to keep it in, if the woggle was too far down or too far up, he would point it out, and you'd have to adjust it. Your hat would have the position of your hat on your head. And of course, if some boys would go home and go playing or something, and if their uniform was getting a bit mucky and that, they would be told that they'd got to have a new uniform or something.
Was the scoutmaster one of the old?
He was a First World War veteran, and my, that's another thing. Going back, if I may digress for a minute, the headmaster of Lusty School, when I was a boy, had served in the 5th Devons in the First World War. And lots of the children that of my age group, he had been with their fathers in the First World War, the 5th Devons. So and again, he used to talk to us, because the 5th Devons, why I'm telling you this, when the war broke, a lot of territorial units were sent to India to relieve our regular army, to get them back smartly to France, to relieve the, because we always kept a first or second battalion in India of different regiments. So they whipped the 5th Devons over to India to bring the second, I think it was, back pretty smartly, either the 1st or 2nd Devons. And so they were in India for a time. They eventually arrived on the Western Front, albeit on the eastern side of it, down towards the French sector. But
getting back to the Boy Scouts, what about the camps? Tell me a bit more about the
camps. Oh, yeah, pretty good fun. Well, there was one fatigue that we had that I repeated when I was a soldier, and that was spud bashing. We had to do our share of spud bashing, and we had to do fatigues around the camp as much as anything else. And then there was this team competition to build us into teams, like. It was no good being selfish or a bully and that sort of thing in the army or in the scouts. Very similar. You start, as they say, if I may put it this way, shouting your mouth off too much, you soon meet your match in the army. Doesn't matter who you are, you'll meet your match. And the same with the Boy Scouts. Although it wasn't aggressive, like, it bet much better to be friends all together. And that's what it happens. When you're a pack of scouts, you go in competitions against other packs that when you're at these camps, there's other packs and there was a competitive spirit that developed, and if one of your team done something, you all cheered loudly, of course, because he was one of you. And exactly the same when you get into the army, it's exactly the same. And when you're in a platoon, though you're almost like brothers. It's a peculiar feeling, or a peculiar sort of characteristic of men. Once they have been together, they bond very quickly. And same with the scouts. So that was good, really. Yes, when we were at camp, we developed. We were disciplined insofar as we had to do fatigues, and all had to do a share. Didn't matter who you were. If you were the parson's son or Major so-and-so's son, you still had to do it. If you're with all the other boys, you had to do your share. For instance, we actually dug the latrines, the same as in the army. We had to dig a latrine, and it was only a pole in them days, a pole across two forked sticks, and you sat on, and woe betide you if you fell off, but and you had washing in a bowl of cold water that you dipped out of the stream, because you usually camp near a stream, and so it was hardening you too. You know, some of the, again, going to the Great War, I do drift a bit because I'm so interested in the Great War. A lot of them young boys that went out to the Western Front had never had their hands dirty. They'd never had sort of a piece of earth fall into the Dixie where a shell had burst and have to fish it out and then eat what they'd never had such things. Whereas the working class boys, they had used to this sort of thing. They'd had bonfires and baked potatoes. Some of them had been farm labourers and miners when they were only boys, really, and there was no facilities to wash their hands, so they had used to this. They certainly took the peck of earth down them before in their life, so they were harder for it, and scouts were definitely a good a member of a good scout group. When he went into the army, he benefited, I tell you. He benefited.
Now, you're getting close to the war now, 1939.
I am, yes.
You were still at school.
I was still at school.
Now, what do you remember of, it's the old joke almost, of the day war broke out?
Well, it so happens that I wasn't in Lusley. I was at a place called Blina in South Wales.
Where?
Blina. Blina, I think it is. Blina. It's in the it's in the valleys, you know. And
what were you doing there?
Well, this is my oldest sister was married, and she married a man from Monmouthshire. He lived down here. He was he'd drifted down here and was working in this part of the world. He's in the hotel trade, and he had a brother that was on the railways, on the Great Western Railways, and he had been down on holiday, and they got free travel warrants and things when they were staff on the Great Western. And it happened that summer, the war broke, he was down staying with my sister and his brother, his own brother, and him and his wife, And they said, "Would I like to come back for have a holiday?" See, because there were school holidays as well. So I was up there, and now they had a flat. It was half a house really, with an old chap. And this old chap, he worked for the council. Now the war was coming, no question about it. So they were rushing around. He was in a lorry, delivering gas masks, civilian gas masks to people. And he had a little granddaughter. She was about the same age as me, and he used to let us get up in the cab of his lorry, and we went around. We didn't do nothing, just sit in the lorry and whatnot. And they were distributing these gas masks, and we knew it was coming. And you know, I hadn't got one myself because I'd had to be issued one in Lusty, but I wanted a gas mask. Well, then this I think it was a Sunday morning when we were in the kitchen. And we were in with the granddad and this little girl and my and the two people that I was staying with, and we were all there, and they told us that there was an important announcement coming on the radio, on the wireless in them days they called it, over the wireless. And sure enough, we heard it, and it said, the words I can remember, that we have asked request they withdraw their troops from Poland. Or for this, say, our fourth, we would be at war. And there'd been no answer, no response to this application. And therefore, and the final words were, "And therefore, this country is at a state of war." And I thought, that's great. You know, I really did. I thought this was great. We're going to go to war. All this. And incidentally, my eldest brother was a soldier. He had been called up in July 19. 39, what they called the militia boys. Hor Belisha was, I think, the Minister of War, and he had all 20-year-olds. And my brother was born in 1918, and he was 20 years old when in July 39, and so he went up. He was one of the first. And they still, in those days, he came home with brass buttons, the same as the First World War. They hadn't shifted. They hadn't got battle dress. In third early in that third part, he went in the artillery. My brother did that one, and I didn't. I wasn't old enough, or shall I put, intelligent enough to realize what war really was. My mother knew it. Mine. I remember my when I soon like when then once the war declared, my. The lady that I was staying with, she was only a young woman. She only died a week ago. She brought me home, got on the train, and brought me back to Lusley. Well, there it was. I had missed the train that came down through the valley, picking up all these territorial boys. And I understand in Lusley, mothers were crying as the boys were going aboard the train, mothers were crying, and they were off. They went down to Newton Abbot. On the first day, they were told to mobilise, got down to Newton Abbot. They had nowhere to billet them, so sent them home again. So mother's tears were all dry when the sun appeared, but they were back in a couple of days' time.
What about, I mean, your mother must have been worried about us.
Well, that's it. She did. And then, and what my, that was, he went, they were going for 6 months, these militia boys. That's what they were called up for, 6 months. And my brother, I only look in today at a little field card that my brother sent to my mother in December, I think it is, 1939. He's in France. My brother was in France in December 39, so he was one of the first to get, you know, some of the first mob over there. They pushed these militia boys that were over there, as they soon had them.
Did you worry about him?
No, I didn't really, honestly, I didn't. Even when it come to Dunkirk, I couldn't believe that, you know, my brother, he'd be all right, you know. So my brother, he was my eldest brother, you see, and he had, in a way, I suppose, I was well down to the bottom of the eight children, second from the bottom, and so he would have been, in a way, the boys aged very quickly. They had to in them days. That brother went out. He would come home when he was only about 15, take me off to the barber's and have my hair cut. You know, the bit of wages he earned to save my mother, he would buy me a pair of boots, like, you know. And so he become a father figure as much as anything. It was only later life, when we got older together, when the age gap closes again. But in them days, he was my eldest brother, and he was a great support to my mother. He had to be, had to take the place of my father a lot of it, in a lot of ways, to help her and the next brother, because they came in steps. If you was to think about it, when they were married in 16 and he died in 28 and 8 children, so they came in steps.
Now, what about, so what effects did the war have on your life? I mean, you were still at school.
Yeah, well, what happened?
You'd be just about to go back for another term, I presume.
I would, that's exactly. Well, I went back, and what happened, there was a shortage of men, dearth of men on the land, workers. So what they done, they allowed schoolboys from Newton Grammar School, they took us out in a lorry on the fields to help with the harvest and this sort of thing. And it was prolonged. Vacuums were coming in and they were filling the schools. And so they didn't mind some of the other children, the native children, going off. See, it was relieving the pressure on the schools. Had all the vacuums come in as well with all the local children, it would have been terrible to try and cope with a lot of them.
So what were you doing? Tell us about the work on the farm.
Oh, yes. I knew about work on the farm. You see, coming from the... We started off with hay, and when I was that boy, I used to, I can remember one farm I was on, I was using the hay rake, and there's a horse pulling a rake, and I had to, my job was to go around and sweep it into lines, so that then they had a hay sweep that swept it and brought it into the rick, and they made hay ricks in them days. They didn't have balers. And I can remember they even trusted me to do that. I was a fairly big boy. I was tall, and but not very big, but robust. But I was fairly tall for my age. And I will tell you how this came on in very short time now, where it benefited me, being tall and so forth. We'd done the hay. Then came the corn harvest in the August of 1940, Battle of Britain time, and I can see us now.
That sort of jumped nearly a year, actually, though. But if you see what I mean, anything else about that year?
Well, I can. Well,
did it affect your life in any other way? Have we got the work?
Well, not really, because it didn't really. Another brother went in the army shortly in 1940. My third brother did.
What about the school? Did it affect your school life at all?
Well, it did.
Tell us about that.
Well. Several of the masters were called up. They were Royal Air Force Reserve people, what they call RAFVR. They had to go. They're the equivalent of the territorials. They're probably one or two of them army. They were cramming, because some of the children being evacuated, they were qualified to go to grammar schools and so forth. They were being evacuated not only from sort of junior schools, they were coming down and they had to cram them in. And in Newton Abbott, they had to have halls, take over halls in the town, several halls. So that when we, at one time, we were all in the one building there. We might have changed classrooms, but we had to come out, form a crocodile of children and all down the road and go to a hall where there was quite elderly people that were coming out of retirement to teach us to help out. This was the pressure of the evacuees coming in, you see, and because as many of them were qualified to go to, I suppose you'd almost call it higher education than the general council schools, and so they had to be catered for. So that was one thing. Rationing didn't seem to affect us at all for a year or two. One of the reasons being living in the country, there was plenty of rabbits to have, so there was no meat problems, and plenty of potatoes and swedes and things like this. Basic foods were quite... Apart from that, there were soldiers moving in Lusley, just above where I live now. There was a small camp set up, where there was about 20 soldiers, one here on Heathfield, just here in Bobby Tracy, Heathfield. And what I've since the war, from studying that, I've realised what it is. There was they weren't just placed in a field just haphazardly. They were part of a chain, so that they were searchlight batteries, so that when the Germans came over the coast from Plymouth and that, heading for Bristol or South Wales, and the searchlights would go up, if they picked up an enemy, they could pass them straight over until, and they were still in their range when the next battery could take over, hand them over, and they could, and if they were accurate enough, they could keep a German plane in or a wounded British RAF plane coming in. Sometimes their own planes come in with no communication at all because their wireless had been damaged, and very often the searchlights brought them into airfields and directed them in with this chain came right across the south of England.
So these soldiers in the field, the camp, they were a searchlight battery?
Searchlight batteries, all Royal Artillery searchlight batteries, yeah.
Did you go up and see, with your fascination, did you go and pester them?
Yes, on the one up where I had, they had a Lewis gun mounted on a tripod as for aircraft protection night. And I used to go up and talk to these soldiers. And when I used to say, I'm going to go in the army as soon as I can, they were obviously conscripts and used to say to me, you'll be a ready idiot if you go in the army, you stay, keep your head down and don't go near that lot. I used to ask them about this Lewis gun, but the sergeant used to get ratty when I used to go in and go in the gun pit with them. I used to go in and go in the gun pit, and they never used to turf me out, but the sergeant didn't like it too much. And I used to go up there at night when the searchlight was up, when they were using their searchlight, because it was right beside the road. I didn't have to go very far, and sit there and listen to the sergeant shouting the commands, and I know exactly how they worked from being a boy. There was two listeners, one a field away, and he sat in a little old canvas chair with big earphones on and a huge, like old gramophone trumpets, and these fellas were direction finders, and they had one each side about half a mile apart, and they had speaker things like tannoy or shouting down to the gun or to the searchlights, and the sergeant would be there, and if the sound was coming so many degrees, he used to tell them so many degrees, and the searchlight would whip around, and I've actually seen them up and pick up planes well up mine, like silver sardines up there, pick them up and take them up, and then I've seen another searchlight picking them up to go on, so I know how they were working like, but it was quite exciting, the searchlight, and of course there was convoys coming through Bobby Tracy.